Hello and welcome to the World Health Business for Good podcast. My guest today is Jen Rodwell, the head of digital ethics and tech for good practice at Soprasteria, one of the world's leading digital transformation companies, where she is responsible for bringing to market services that address societal concerns. Jen is passionate about the power of technology, innovation and entrepreneurship to change the world for the better. She's also a member of the World Health School's National Advisory Board and has been a member of the Tech UK Women in Tech Council. Jen, thank you so much for joining us today. To help our listeners to get to know you better, can you tell us a bit about yourself and how you got to where you are today?
Thanks, Mick. I'm really delighted to be here speaking with you today. So I guess that's a tough question because I don't think that there was necessarily a path. And if there was, it was very windy and possibly quite obscured. I guess if I think about what motivates me, that has been consistent throughout my life and probably was the light shining in the darkness that that I walked towards over the course of many years. I think about my childhood in Minnesota, growing up in a very stable, happy home, two parents and a younger brother. Very loving and having access to kind of all of the things that make a good, happy and safe childhood, and not really ever kind of questioning that or feeling that was anything unusual until I started to see some of the world and see that it wasn't that way for everybody. And my parents' background, I think, is really interesting too. So both parents come from ultimately farming backgrounds, and they didn't have to necessarily end up where they were either, providing kind of a middle-class stable life for two young kids. Their parents and their parents' parents came out of the Great Depression and had tremendously difficult times. But both of my parents ended up in a place where they were able to provide very well for two kids and provide a very good, solid foundation for life. So I think about that a lot in terms of how I'm privileged and that not everybody has that kind of opportunity and that privilege and that start. When I think about how people don't necessarily have access to the education and the opportunities, even though they're just as smart and hardworking as my parents were, or as I am certainly. And so thinking about that unfairness, I guess, and wanting to make sure that people everywhere have the chance to live the best, most fruitful and fulfilling lives they can is really fundamentally what's been behind the things I've tried out in life. So the winding path then takes me to university where I studied film, which is kind of unusual. But I thought film was a good medium.
Where did you study that, Jen?
In Chicago at a film school called Columbia College, and had a really good experience there and tested out some of the theories about film as a medium to address and amplify social concerns. Was convinced I was an artist when I left and went on my merry way living living a life like an artist, which really just means poor.
I can relate to that. I can relate to that.
Not particularly productive. And thank goodness I had some good experiences that kept me on the path of just being interested in social topics. And eventually I came to a place where I wanted to perhaps study human rights law. And I was living in Paris at the time and working for a financial services startup, and had decided that I needed to shift gears and finally do something a bit more structured. And human rights law was the thing. But this job gave me the opportunity to go try out something called microfinance and look at it from that firm's perspective to see if microfinance could form part of our community giving program. So it was a really small firm, But it was they were they really wanted to have some sort of CSR. And again, this is kind of the first time I'd ever heard of anything like corporate social responsibility. And I went to Ecuador and saw how microfinance absolutely transformed the lives of the particularly women and children, but families in general, who were in absolute dire poverty, but gave them a chance to create a sustainable life for themselves, send their kids to school, women to start and expand businesses that gave them agency in their families, in their communities, and in their world. And that was my introduction to corporate social responsibility. And I thought, okay, wait a minute, I'd never thought about business as a particular driving force for good. And so I just stopped everything and decided I would go pursue an MBA with a focus on corporate social responsibility. Long story short, after that MBA, I got my first position working in sustainability at a technology company, had a wonderful opportunity there to look at how we could bring technology-oriented sustainability services to customers. And shortly after that, had a similar opportunity at Sopra Steria, where I am now. And I've been working the past decade to bring sustainability life through technology and business, working with customers and within Sopra Steria. And now that's shifted a little bit to really, really focus on some of the biggest issues that are facing us right now with the intersection of things like technology, business, ethics, and sustainability all coming together. And that's why we've started this Digital Ethics and Tech for Good practice.
This is my favorite part of the podcast, when people that I know well in business give me an insight into their journey, and there's always surprises in it, Jen, always surprises. And before we move on to, I really want to get into what digital ethics means, because I find even your title fascinating. I want to come back to a question I always like to ask is, so you brought up a really privileged and fortunate environment because your parents' hard work and the price your ancestors paid going through the Depression, etc. But not all kids would have been aware of their privilege. They would have just taken it for granted, or they would have just have gone on and lived a life, a wonderful life in the Midwest of the States. What was it? Was it you, something in you personally, or was it your parents or family's values that made you so aware of your privilege, and then, more importantly, made you want to do something to help people that didn't have that? Where did that come from?
I am absolutely sure it's some of the values that my parents instilled in us. And it's not through necessarily particularly strong religious ties or big speeches or anything that my parents compelled this, but just by being decent and welcoming everybody and being good neighbors and things like that, that they demonstrated through life. But I also think that there's just this sense that it was unfair that not everybody had the opportunity that I did. Because I don't think it's just, to pick up on what you said, I don't think it's just because of hard work of my ancestors and my parents that I have what I have. There are institutional barriers that persist today, and we're seeing the fallout of these barriers now with a lot of anger and hurt happening, especially in, you know, back where I come from, being expressed and justifiably, because there are just tremendously unfair barriers to people who are equally as talented and equally as hardworking. And it's more than time for that to change. And I think that's what's driven me and lots of the people that I have the privilege of working with.
So before we come on to the specifics again of your current role and examples of that, can you give us an indication on that journey that you went on, that either you can take answer one of these questions. Has there been an apparent failure or something that was a real setback in your life that you're actually grateful for now? Or you could answer both. What are you most proud of in that journey, or most proud of in your career in general?
Wow, those are big questions. Probably too many failures to list, but maybe it's the two combined, actually. And this is going to sound a bit clever, but I genuinely mean this. It is the consistent and repeated failures that have led to the things that I'm most proud of, I suppose. I guess what I'm most proud of is that I do a job that I love and that I'm excited about every single day, and that I get to be creative in and work with, you know, the smartest, most caring people in the world. And I get to work on things that genuinely make a difference in the world. And I have a lot of creative freedom as well, which I'm very thankful for in my job. So I'm most proud that I've achieved those things, because they're, I think, quite difficult for people to find. So I'm proud of that, and also recognize that I'm lucky. Mm-hmm. But aside from the luck component of that, it's the willingness to take risks and have lots of failures, as I do, that have led me to where I am. So it's mistakes like I wouldn't say I'm very happy I went to film school. It was amazing, but I did not pursue the straight and narrow path. I chose all sorts of wild things to do in my life, and I probably would have been making more money and higher up the corporate ranks, perhaps, if I'd made decisions on the straight and narrow path that led me down the straight and narrow path. But experimentation, risk, and failure have led to something that I'm really, really happy about.
Jen, the word straight and narrow don't really jump into my mind when I think of you. And, you know, it's the whole artistic process, which is the entrepreneurial process, but trial and error and keeping going. And I think it's wonderful, as you've pointed out, is that money and wealth are not the same things. And people may be higher up a corporate ladder, if such a thing exists, but not have any the sense of satisfaction that you've achieved, which is wonderful. I want to talk to you now, but even when you told me, when we were chatting last year, I think, and you were saying that you'd recently had a significant promotion and you were now head of digital ethics. And the thing that struck me is I just thought the business title was amazing. It was such an intriguing business title, this idea of digital ethics, because all the stuff about manipulation of elections and, you know, the side of tech that I don't think people had ever been aware of was coming out into the fore. What are digital ethics, Jen, and why are they necessary?
It's a really good question, and you've touched on it in the lead up to your question there. So digital ethics is all about kind of taking a step back from digital or technology, really, as tools, and asking ourselves what is the power of these tools that we're using now, and what will go right and what will go wrong with them before we deploy them on a massive scale. So technology is just a tool, and it can be used for good or for bad. And I think that there was so much promise and so much exuberance about technology for the past 2 or 3 decades, and there still is, and there should be, because technology is absolutely transformational, not only for businesses but for the world, and will be key to solving some of our most critical challenges. But I think what we've seen in more recent years is a recognition that these tools have to be created thoughtfully and carefully, and then used thoughtfully and carefully, recognizing that when you do something with a digital technology, the impact, whether it's good or bad, is going to be amplified much more quickly and on a much bigger scale than it would be before we use these technologies, these big technologies. So when we think about ethics and in digital technologies, it's asking ourselves about what the potential good and bad is before these things are too far down the road, to avoid some of the things you've described, like even the Cambridge Analytica scandal and Facebook. And we're approaching another election in the US that faces probably similar risks, although Facebook is starting to put some guardrails in place now. Facebook is kind of an obvious one, but even if we think about the A-level scandal of the recent news here in the UK, it demonstrates how algorithms that are designed probably genuinely with a benevolent intent or an intent to be fair still struggle with that original intention because they haven't had enough testing and insight from other experts. And thinking about the implications on a diverse range of people in the instances of the A-level scandal.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's such a vast subject. I think, to your point, and exuberance is a great word to describe the way evangelical tech gurus would talk about, you know, the great liberating force of technology and how it was going to level the field for everybody and create this almost harmonious world. And I think it's when human nature interacts with tech that you get increased atomization or tribalism, and in many ways it's had the opposite effect. I think I'd love us to explore this more, the idea of, you know, the law of unforeseen circumstances. So you and I touched on this in one of our previous conversations. When Gutenberg invented the printing press, I suspect strongly he didn't know it was going to lead to the Reformation, which would then would lead to the Industrial Revolution, or the Enlightenment and Industrial Revolution, and then all the things that flowed from that, simply because people had access to information. And then if we take almost like the internet, it's like that on steroids. Could you think of any examples of the unforeseen consequences of the growth of tech that the people who developed that technology could never have imagined happening, good and bad?
Sure. Well, I mean, exactly. Well, this is exactly what digital ethics is meant to help with. So there are millions of examples, literally, because they are as many as the different technologies and the different scenarios in which those technologies are deployed. But I think there's been one that's bothered me quite recently, if we're talking about the negative side of things. An organization called Robinhood in the US has created quite an interesting platform, actually, to make investing more accessible to people who aren't investors by trade, which is great. I think that that's in principle about financial inclusion and you know, making these products and services more available to people who previously would have been kept out because of jargon and complexity. But in this instance, they used gamification on their platform to encourage people to invest while also showing users both the minute-to-minute kind of live wins and losses in their trading accounts. And users in the US were investing money for the first time, getting excited because of the gamification and the really smart user experience. And almost it became like a gambling casino scenario for some people. And one young man in the States saw that his account had a loss of several hundred thousand dollars and went into deepest despair because he thought, how am I ever going to pay that back? And he, very, very sadly, he committed suicide. And that is, I recognize, an extreme example, but it serves to illustrate this point that when we use things like gamification or even really, really smart user experience and user and design, it's so important to think about the potential consequences to individuals and on society more broadly. And it's not always possible to game out every potential scenario and avoid everything. But I think what we have seen is probably a lack of consistent and systematic thinking about these things before the technology is created and deployed. And there's an opportunity to just take a moment to think about these things and do it iteratively, make mistakes, get it, and then improve. But people get, I think, rightly very excited about the technology and don't stop and do this thinking that we're asking be done.
Do you know, that reminds me, we're working with, Wild Hearts is working with an amazing woman called Alicia Drummond, who's one of the UK's leading therapists and mental health experts for teenagers. And it's all part of the Wild Hearts Schools program. We now want to empower kids to understand and look after their own mental well-being. And one of the things we discussed is in the American context, and I suspect it can be mirrored exactly in the UK, is two of the key contributors to the explosion of mental health problems with teenagers was Facebook lowering their age of access to 13. So a little 11-year-old girl, if she lied, could get access to Facebook. At the same time, the mass availability of the iPhone. And therefore, this little girl could go on internet or go on Facebook without having to be in a laptop, which maybe her mum could see in the dining room or the office in the house or living room or something. So this 11-year-old had access to Facebook on a handheld device away from her parents' supervision. And it has been catastrophic, the effect it's had on kids, particularly girls' mental health. Now, of course, the inventors of the iPhone and the developers of Facebook didn't see that coming. How on earth are you meant to see the future like that, Jen? How are you meant to see into the future with that level of accuracy?
Well, it won't be with that level of accuracy, for that is certain. But we know from the past decade or 15 years probably enough to challenge ourselves throughout the design process and think about a wide variety of use cases. I mean, the criticism that gets lobbed at Silicon Valley developers, and fairly, I think, in many cases, is that there's not very much diversity, and they create technology based on their experience and usually based on their experience and for people like themselves. So they wouldn't have imagined an 11-year-old girl or the many teenage girls and boys who are now suffering mental health because of their products, everything from loneliness and isolation to eating disorders and inflated expectations about what their bodies should look like and what their lives should look like. And those are big issues. And again, I'm not suggesting that there is a way to anticipate every single potential negative outcome, but there has been to date really a severe absence of even trying to imagine some of the negative consequences. And there are people who do these things. I mean, you can work with futurologists and people who do think about game theory to game out some of what might happen, but less kind of whizzy and experimental is some of the practices that are rooted in tech, like service design, design thinking, user experience, user research. But just taking that from a change in perspective. So you're not necessarily just thinking about how to design the most frictionless service so that you get the most users doing the most things that make you the most money, but you're thinking about it from an ethics perspective and a human perspective as well. So it's the same principles, just widening the thinking a bit.
Okay, so coming on to the more positive examples then. I read an article recently where you said, it's Opera Story, we want to use technology as a force for good, contributing to a positive future and improving people's lives. Can you give us some examples of how you're doing this? Because I've only highlighted the negative aspects of tech so far.
Sure. And thanks for bringing us back to that, because of course there is the other side of this, that technology is absolutely critical to and critical to solving the world's challenges, but also is already contributing massively to that solving. I mean, say what you will about Zoom's early privacy issues during the early days of the pandemic, when it was suddenly revealed that we could log on to Boris Johnson's calls if we wanted, because his PIN number had been displayed. The role technology has played in connecting those of us who are privileged enough to have it at home and have connectivity is tremendous and hugely beneficial. But in our work, I guess one of the examples, I'll talk maybe about a couple of examples that we're really proud of at the moment. So we're working with a public sector organization who wants to fundamentally provide citizens with a better user experience on their web platform. And what that means to them is just helping them find the information that they're seeking on their website as easily as possible, as quickly as possible, but also knowing enough about what that user might actually want to know in addition to their initial search query to put the right and most helpful information in front of them, even if it's not what they first went looking for. And they see that as part of this mission to better connect to citizens and to help citizens feel better connected to the community and to the council. And they're going to do that by using more data. So they've asked us to help them understand how to use data to achieve those goals, which are fundamentally benevolent goals for citizens, but do it ethically. So we're talking with them about ethics within their community, within their organization, what citizens' expectations are around public sector organizations' use of data, what citizens' values are that should inform a digital ethics approach for data, and then we'll help them actually create a program to so they understand. So they've actually created their own kind of data ethics framework. So they can say, in this scenario, we will use citizen data because we know it has a genuine citizen benefit. But in this scenario, we probably won't do that because the benefit to the citizen isn't as strong as the benefit to us or the risk of something going wrong with use of data, like a data breach. So it's taking them through the process so they can do what starts out as a fundamentally good thing, but to make sure that the citizens' best interests are in mind. So there's a tendency to think that, well, it's often said data is the new gold or the new oil. The more of it you have, the richer you'll be. And that's really in conflict with digital ethics and with data ethics, because there's so much risk in what could happen to users and citizens if that data is misused. So that's one thing that we're really excited about right now. And the other project is on the tech for good side, so about creating technology from the very beginning that is specifically focused on addressing a social issue. We're working with our charity partner ELAT, which is a digital skills charity in London, and they provide digital skills training and qualifications to some of the most underserved people in London. And that's everybody from people with learning difficulties to multi-generational unemployment to refugees and asylum seekers, and giving people a chance to get into the world of work in a productive and well-paying good job. So we're working with them to create a digital platform that will help people like their students, but actually like lots and lots of people who are about to face a lot of change because of technology-driven disruption in the jobs market. So Mick, there are some incredible stats right now about how technology is going to very quickly change the world of work. And we're seeing that on an accelerated scale since COVID, really. But before COVID, the statistics were that there are 6 million people in the UK who in the next few years who are right now in jobs that in the next few years will disappear or be radically transformed because of changing demographics and technology. And all of those people will need to get into other kinds of work, and we don't yet know necessarily what that work looks like. We know some of it, but not all of it. And if we're going to undertake a reskilling program nationally on that scale, digital technology has to play a role in that, because it's not going to be classroom based. It's not going to be down to the schools and the universities and the colleges. It has to, in the traditional sense, it has to happen online using technology at scale. Interestingly, though, we don't know that much. I mean, we collectively don't know that much about what makes a quality digital learning experience, what's effective. A lot of the digital learning experiences have been based on traditional models, traditional classroom models. So we face high costs. Courses can be quite expensive. We face barriers in terms of the time it takes to engage with digital learning. which isn't going to be appropriate for people who have families and other work commitments. It's not your typical university student types who are going to be needing this kind of reskilling and upskilling. So all sorts of barriers. Mm-hmm. And then in terms of an actual digital experience and how people absorb the information they're getting through learning in a digital environment. So right now, Soprasteria is testing out hypotheses with technology and real life people who are likely to be in this scenario to see what works and to build technology interventions to help drive a more effective learning experience for people. So for example, we might use something like a chatbot to help people who might be stalling a little bit in their studies and might need a friendly little prompt to help them feel confident that they can engage, or if they're not able to engage on the digital platform, then a human tutor or instructor or coach or mentor or colleague could come on and help them wherever they're having trouble. Or we will use AI potentially and automation and personalization to create a tailored learning experience based on what we know about an individual and their circumstances. Do they have the ability to spend 5 minutes a day learning, or do they have an hour and a half to really engage with something longer and to personalize the content with that? And all of that is really about helping people find the best pathways to learning so that they can engage with content that will help them into the world of work that's fast approaching for many of us.
It's absolutely fascinating, the power of tech and the impact it can have on education. We saw it during the lockdown with MicroTycho. So many kids have been taking part in MicroTycho in their schools, and we pivoted very quickly into a virtual competition, and the numbers expanded exponentially, and we would never even consider doing that unless there'd been a schools lockdown. This leads me on to a point that you said in a recent article, which was, when we return from the crisis, you said, well, we're returning to a world that uses more tech, not less. That means that the ethical challenges that existed before the pandemic will be accelerated unless we've laid the groundwork and equipped ourselves to make better decisions. And two areas that you highlighted was access to services, unintended discrimination or bias, or the other one that I'm personally fascinated about is, how do we use tech to protect people from social isolation? This idea that, you know, if you don't have access to tech and there's some kids getting an enhanced, enriched education experience, and then there's the other kid who doesn't have access, they're going to fall further behind. So we'll actually worsen social mobility or social exclusion. How can tech address these issues? What are you doing to address them?
The social isolation and potential for massive inequality, deepening the existing inequality quickly and entrenching it more because of COVID, is one of my biggest concerns right now, for exactly the reasons you've described. The kids who were already disadvantaged are just exponentially more disadvantaged in this environment, and we have to solve that. I've been heartened very recently to hear about some of the work that local governments are doing, and it's not cheap and it's not easy, but they're putting that aside and just saying, we need to get technology out to people who don't have it, to kids and families who don't have it, no matter the cost, because the long-term cost to our societies, and of course the individuals, is unconscionable. So they're sending out Wi-Fi dongles and hotspots and laptops and the technology that families need to get these kids involved. And it's not perfect. I mean, young kids in particular will just probably not be able to engage with virtual digital education in a way that is as effective as in-person learning. And that's something we need to get to grips with. And hopefully there will be a solution to the virus soon, so we can move beyond that. But those interventions are really, really critical. So the second thing about social isolation and growing inequality, I think, is it's a real bee in my bonnet, actually, Mick, because AI and these amazing technologies that are going to help organizations in the world solve some of the biggest problems. There's so much potential, but there is a lot of work to do left, I think, on addressing the bias that's inherent in so is not inherent, that is just in so many of these technologies and these solutions. There's a lot of talk about the promise of these technologies to enable better decision making. And when you're thinking about this as a, I don't know, a central government department trying to imagine what public policy should be in using technology and data and analytics and AI to make huge decisions, or a business trying to make big decisions because you have the data, the analytics, and the AI. If those decisions are based on data that's flawed or processing and algorithms that's flawed with bias, then we're not actually making better decisions, and that's what drives me crazy. And there's a lot of interesting kind of conversation about human versus machine. It's never that simple, is it? Because of course humans are biased as well, and probably the best approach to using these technologies and to making decisions is to equip humans to interpret data and to use recommendations from machines to make the decisions that are actually right, because we can always hold a human responsible more than we can hold a machine responsible. But what I'm really getting at here is that as these technologies are more and more widely deployed in all sorts of instances, including in education, if we don't fix this bias problem, then we're just more deeply entrenching this inequality. And there's so that we can do better. We absolutely can do better. We know this is an issue. And I'm just encouraged by the fact that people are thinking about this, but we have to get it right before these technologies become de facto and so widespread that everything that we see flaws and bias everywhere.
Jen, could you give us an example of how somebody interacting with AI, perhaps not even realizing that they're chatting with or interacting with a machine rather than a human, that what kind of discrimination or bias they could experience?
Sure, that's such an interesting question. And actually, there's a bigger question, I think, ethically about whether it's right for us to not know whether we're interacting with a human or not. We would say absolutely not. And there needs to be more clarity around when we're talking to a machine and when we're not. But from a bias perspective, some of these solutions just haven't been... I haven't thought about different kinds of users and how they might come with different questions or different needs. And you see this in the form of chatbots and voice recognition systems not recognizing certain dialects or different accents, and therefore not being able to provide a service. And that might not be such a big deal if you just want to, I don't know, browse on a website and perhaps purchase a roll of toilet paper or something. But if you're inquiring about your benefits or something that actually has real impact on your life, you need to be able to get a certain quality of service. And there are lots of, this is changing quite rapidly, and organizations and developers are getting this, and the technology to understand a wider variety of users has improved massively. But we need to keep an eye on that and make sure that it continues to evolve and consider a wide variety of user needs. The other thing I would say, not necessarily about chatbots, but facial recognition, we've got such interesting movements in the technology market for facial recognition, thanks in huge part to the Black Lives Matter movement. And seeing that companies, that the makers of these technologies now are not willing to send them into a marketplace where they can't necessarily control the ethics around their use. So if there's an uncertainty in their accuracy and that's translated into bias against citizens, then the vendors are actually pulling that from market. So with facial recognition technology, I think some of the best ones can only claim an upward accuracy range of 70 or 80%. So that means that in some instances, police might have a 30% chance of interacting with someone who isn't meant to be accused of anything. And that can lead to all sorts of negative impacts, as we've seen play out, particularly in the States.
30% error for interacting with the police is quite alarming.
Yeah, again, if you're just buying some new role and you know, your chatbot doesn't recognize what you want, the consequences are very small, so it doesn't matter. But when you get into these life-changing events, thinking about how somebody interacts with the justice system, a 30% error rate or thereabouts is unacceptable.
Jen, coming to the voice recognition, I remember when back in the day when it first came out, and you know, these tech gurus that I was talking to were really excited that this you could just speak to your laptop and it would type for you. My friends and I all knew that it wouldn't recognize Scottish accents. It took about 10 years of development before. I mean, I was very pleasantly surprised when I chatted away and the computer understood me perfectly. I was like, oh, wow, they've evolved. They can understand a Scottish accent. So we're brought up to so it's interesting that, there's a whole series of jokes about that. The future is positive, though. I think, again, in that same article that I've been quoting you from quite throughout this interview, you said across all metrics, companies that think and act in an ethical and sustainable way outperform those that don't. That is something that gives me such faith for the future of business in the world. Why do you think that is the case, that companies that are doing the right thing and are implementing the policies and thought processes that you champion, that they're actually commercially performing better?
Yeah, it's, again, really, really important to not get too bogged down in the risk and the dark side, because the flip side of everything we've talked about is actually tremendous opportunity. So even when we're talking about bias and unfairness in service and that potential, the mirror image of that is actually what could happen for businesses if they avoid that, if they eliminate the unfairness and the bias. Well, then that user, that citizen, has a very positive experience of their organization. And if we're talking about a commercial organization, is a new customer who's totally bought into, who's had a great experience and is totally bought into the brand and is with you. So I guess to answer your question, when organizations excel at some of these ethical principles, like getting diversity and inclusion right, and showcasing their values as part of their brand and their image, they do financially perform better. So we know that companies with strong ethical and sustainability credentials outperform the market on almost all metrics, but by 14.4%, I think I read in some recent study, in terms of revenue. But it's revenue, it's profitability, it's market capitalization, employee engagement, ability to attract talent and retain talent. All of these are the business benefits of getting this stuff right. And it all kind of makes sense, doesn't it? Because if you have diversity in your organizations, then you've got a whole bunch of smart people from different perspectives challenging positively what you're doing and contributing different views to make what you do better before you even bring it to market. And then then when you do bring it to market and it's made for the widest group of people with their values and their needs and their expectations in mind, then you've just opened up your product or service to a much wider group of people. So you've got more customers, more satisfied customers. So it just makes tremendous sense to do this stuff and to put the work in.
The point you make about diversity of mind is crucial. You know, I think people think of diversity of whether our religious backgrounds or racial background or whatever, but the idea of differences of opinions and people seeing things differently, then you always end up getting a far more robust and product that's fit for purpose if you've got people with different perspectives contributing to it. I mean, you're right. I mean, in this chat, it's made it sound as if we're all talking about this dystopian future because of tech. I think, to your point, it's because tech is so transformative. It's delivered so many incredible freedoms and, evolutions, if you will, that's benefited people. I think it's because we know it's going to expand that we're having a conversation of the people who are being left behind on its negative impact, because all we ever heard was, all anybody ever spoke about before was, again, that very evangelical tone about the only thing tech was going to deliver was benefits. And we're going, well, not so much. But it's because it is so all-pervasive. I think it's fantastic we now have leaders like you that say, well, look, let's look at the potential downside. I mean, as you and I have chatted before, the people who will not have access to tech because of its all-pervasive nature now will almost be like the illiterates of the past. And how curtailed would your life be if you literally couldn't read? So I think that's why it's such a serious subject and people are talking about it now. Looking to the future, you've said that you believe the message, and I hope you're flattered, Jen. I've been reading all your articles avidly. I've been quoting you throughout this. You've said that you believe the message that sustainable businesses are more likely to be successful is gaining traction. And this was a line that you said, which I really liked, that the conversation around CSR had changed from one of corporate responsibility to more of a mind of opportunity, of getting it right. What opportunities do you see? What were the ones that you're most excited about if we get this right?
Absolutely. Well, I think it is exactly as we were just discussing, that no matter how you look at this, there are advantages to doing it right. Now, I'm not saying that there's not money to be made doing it the wrong way, because there are lots and lots of examples of companies, Facebook, Google, depending on what you think of them, making, or Uber, a good example as well, making lots of money and just kind of riding out the ethical criticism that they're getting. But most organizations are not going to be Google's, Facebook's, or Uber's, and nor should they be. And you can do very, very well while doing very, very good, I think, is the answer. So it is about making better products for a wider group of users or customers or citizens. The other thing that strikes me from what you just said is we talked a lot about this displacement challenge that's being driven by technologies like automation and the need to rapidly reskill. But the bright side of this is that if we do this, there's huge benefits to that, because we've been facing a skills gap in the West and in the UK in particular for many years, where we don't have enough people to fill the jobs that are opening up. And those are the kind of newish jobs that we have now. But the jobs that are on the horizon, the types of jobs and the opportunity for people to get into really interesting work is coming right down at us, and they need people. So this is an opportunity for us to kind of throw aside the tendency that we have to look at our organizations in silos and say, well, we no longer need this kind of role, so we're going to get rid of the person in that role. But we have an opportunity over here that we're not thinking about, because there's no way that person X is going to fit this opportunity Y. But actually, why not is the question. Technology skills are really important, and they will continue to be important. But the value equally of the right kinds of behaviors and values and experience and knowledge and relationship with customers, you can't get that quickly, and you can't get that through training courses. So encouraging us all and organizations to think about the opportunities that they have to address some of these challenges like displacement by looking inside their own organizations and giving people, their own people, a chance to step in to these new and exciting roles is another opportunity that really excites me.
I couldn't agree more. You know, there's one thing that I take so much faith from, lessons of history. the idea of Luddites came from the people smashing up the advanced spinning wheels and spinning jennies, etc., because the artisans were being put out of business because it was getting, mechanization was making them redundant effectively, and so they smashed them up. But look at all the new people, all the new roles and jobs that were created since then, since like the 17, 1800s. One personal thing on tech, I got my break in entrepreneurship because of the dot-com boom. I saw tech as such a massive liberator and leveler. My grandfather was a miner when he was 12. My dad was raised in a slum and was a manual laborer. It was tech that got me the chance to basically go on a different path from what was being laid down for working class kids. And so there is the positive is massively outweighs the negative. I think it's just we've been focusing on perhaps some of the responsibilities that comes with that success.
Exactly. I'm glad you mentioned the first industrial revolution, because this is kind of the driver for us and our work on that particular issue. Is we are in the fourth industrial revolution right now. So we've been through this three times before, and everyone always says that new jobs were created, so we shouldn't worry about the fourth industrial revolution. And I kind of get that. There are mixed views on the degree to which that's true this time around. But even taking a positive view and saying, yes, it will all work out in the end, it's just we have such an opportunity to learn to take what we've learned in three previous industrial revolutions and try to avoid some of the pain, so people don't have to smash up the technology. They more of them will embrace it because we've brought people along with us.
Exactly so. So let me come to our final question of the day, Jen. I've really, really enjoyed chatting to you, and I was so looking forward to this podcast for some time now. Jen, I know that you'll have inspired so many of our listeners today the way you've inspired me. What advice would you give to someone working in the tech space, or indeed anyone interested in sustainability, who want to play their part and create a more ethical digital future?
That's a really good question, Mick. So I think there are, first of all, this is a growing space, and it's rife with opportunity for a huge number of different kinds of people. So you can be a techie and come in and focus on how to use technology and data and sophisticated modeling to address things like climate change. Or you can come from a humanities background or a pure business background. There are a huge number of roles we're seeing open up in the sustainability space and technology and ethics space. But primarily, I would just say, be inspired by your own values and what change you want to see in the world, and bring that to your job. Organizations now more than ever are listening to their employees and to others outside their organization about their expectations of businesses and organizations playing a role in some of these issues. So be that voice, join the conversation, and live your values in your work. And then when you're ready, come and apply for some of the jobs that are opening up in this space.
Excellent. Well, Jen, thank you so much for your time. I've really, really enjoyed talking to you today. And I look forward to seeing you again soon.
Thank you so much, Mick. It's been lovely.